All right, this is our June 14th oral argument calendar. The first case is the personal restraint of Eagle, and the petitioner may proceed.
Thank you, and may it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Ellis. I'm here today on behalf of petitioner Mr. Eagle. I'll save 2 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Let me start by reading an excerpt from a New York Times article from July of 1994, and it's about an arraignment, and it says that the defendant was asked, "Do you understand the charges against you, sir?" Judge Mills asked. The defendant, dressed in a dark blue suit, quickly and forcefully replied, "Yes, Your Honor." Then, in a moment that in most cases is a foregone conclusion, but nevertheless is always a good piece of drama, Judge Mills went to the heart of the day's work. "How do you plead?" he asked. Mr. Simpson, that's O.J. Simpson, who had seemed subdued in many earlier court appearances, noticeably squared his shoulders and then declared, and I may not need to actually read it because I'm sure it's well remembered, "Absolutely, 100% not guilty." That is one of the powers of arraignment. What I'm going to try to do today is trace, though, a very narrow path, and that path is the claim that is raised regarding ineffective assistance of appellate counsel for failing to raise the public trial violation on direct appeal. Because the state concedes, first of all, that the courtroom was closed during arraignment. They concede that, at least for the original arraignment, that the right to public trial attaches. And they also concede in the sense that they try to argue that Morris should be overruled by this court, which this court respectfully can't do since it's a decision of the Washington Supreme Court, that the standard for review, at least in terms of prejudice, is whether the error would have resulted in reversal on direct appeal. And, of course, a public trial violation is a structural error on direct appeal.
Reversal of what? Reversal of the trial?
Reversal
or is it that there would be a remand to have another arraignment?
It would be reversal of the conviction and remand for a new trial. Because we could always parse out individual pieces.
Well, the court's done that.
In what cases is the court concerned about?
I'm not concerned about any particular case, but, when you look at the structural error doctrine, it has to do with the integrity of the trial. And so there has been a distinction in the case law about what those particular components are that the court looks at. This has not been identified as one of them. So I think in the briefing there is an identification of what has been identified as structural error. So the question is, why is this structural error that would result in reversal of the conviction?
Well, it's a structural error because the right to public trial attaches at an arraignment. The right to a public trial not only serves to keep the participants in trial, witnesses, judges, lawyers, defendants, victims, honest and forthright, it also serves the public integrity. And I think anybody who, and I know this bench has previously served in the Superior Court, anybody who's been in courtroom 1201 in the King County Courthouse knows the intense scrutiny that comes with an arraignment. In fact, in many cases, reporters show up for arraignment, the audience is packed at arraignment, and you never see anybody else again in the individual case.
Let me ask, I was looking at State v. Wise, and one of the things it says in that case is where a public trial right violation occurs at a suppression hearing or some other easily separable part of a trial, remand for a public hearing may be appropriate. Why would not an arraignment be an easily separable part of this proceeding? Often the arraignment occurs months before the trial court, so it seems to me it's fairly easily separable. So why shouldn't the remedy be a new arraignment, if anything?
Well, because the arraignment is the thing that puts in motion the entire case. It is the thing that is both notice from the state's perspective and the response from the defendant's perspective. If the court simply said any time that an arraignment is done in a closed courtroom, the remedy after conviction is simply to rearraign, then every arraignment can be conducted in secret. with the remedy only being remand later to do it again. And you could do that with essentially virtually any part of trial unless it went to the issue of whether there is a likelihood that the witness would have testified in a different way.
Well, so, doing voir dire, for example, right? Because
right.
voir dire, you're selecting the jury, and that's the jury that ends up trying the case. So that voir dire is really an inseparable part of the proceeding of the trial itself. So the remedy there clearly would be a new trial. But the example they use is a suppression hearing, which is conducted separate and apart from the trial, and here the arraignment is conducted separate and apart from the trial. So I have difficulty seeing the connection there.
Well, the remedy for a suppression hearing is to do it again because it relates only to the evidence that the state can present. And so it's very easy to partition that out and look at what you're left with. Here, essentially, what you do is you make the right to a public arraignment meaningless, because you will always find, I submit, that there isn't any prejudice if you separate it out. Essentially, what you're saying is it's good and it's fine to do arraignments in the public, judges, trial judges, if you want to, but if you don't worry about it, because we'll never reverse. We'll simply tell you to do it again if it comes up on appeal or in a post-conviction proceeding.
Well, I think Mr. Eagle had a public arraignment here initially. He just wasn't arraigned publicly on this amended information.
Correct.
Does that matter for purposes of our analysis?
Well, you know, that's the point that the state makes, that somehow there's some distinction between an arraignment and a rearrangement. And you know, at the risk of oversimplification, my point is an arraignment is an arraignment is an arraignment, and that significant things can happen at arraignment. The state can drastically increase charges. They could drastically decrease charges, just as the defendant's reaction to those new set of charges is important. There are instances where the amendment is really one that is ministerial or doesn't affect substantial rights, and in those cases, there's no need for an arraignment, and therefore, in that instance, I would agree that the right to a public trial doesn't attach. But where the arraignment happens, again, I think it would be very difficult to draw some sort of distinction and say, well, that arraignment needed to happen in a public forum, but this other arraignment didn't.
Can you give me an example of a ministerial arraignment or a ministerial amendment that would not require an arraignment?
I think it could be changing the dates of a charge.
But even that might be significant, for example, if alibi was a defense.
It could be significant in some cases. In some cases, there could be, you know, the misspelling. Let me go to really small. It could be the misspelling of a name to get it right, that kind of thing. Again, there is case law that deals with when an amended information doesn't require a rearrangement. My point is, if an arraignment happens, that's an arraignment. It doesn't matter if it's the first, second, or tenth.
All right, you have 2 minutes. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Hillary Thomas for the State of Washington.
Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, it appears to me that either counsel is abandoning his straightforward personal restraint petition in the context of just a violation of the right to public trial, because otherwise he would have to prove actual and substantial prejudice from from that violation. And it appears to me that he is proceeding solely upon the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that was made in the petition.
Well, I think we presume that he's focused on the second argument, but hasn't abandoned the first, but we can ask in rebuttal.
With respect to that, Your Honor, counsel has a number of burdens. First of all, he has to show that counsel was ineffective at the time that appellate counsel, at the time that she filed her briefing with respect to this case. And at the time that that she had filed her briefing in this case, Estate versus Sublett had not been, the Supreme Court opinion had not been issued. The experience and logic test had not been adopted. And the test in this court and in the other divisions was the factual versus legal test or the ministerial test as to whether or not the right to public trial was implicated.
So is it...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, so adversarial.
Adversarial. Was it an adversarial proceeding?
Aren't arraignments frequently adversarial? You know, for example, I want to plead not guilty by reason and insanity, or I want to have my bail reduced, or I want to continue the arraignment because I don't have an attorney. One side objects. Wouldn't it almost always be adversarial?
Certainly, there could be some arraignments that are adversarial. However, what the court has said, the Supreme Court has said in State versus Russell and a couple other cases, is that you have to look at the actual proceeding that occurred. You cannot do a broad brush, which petitioner wants to do, and just simply say arraignments. So in this case, the only thing that happened in court, in chambers, was they went into chambers and he waived the information, so there was no reading of the information and the actual charges, and he said not guilty. That was it.
You're saying here's the test at the time appellate counsel filed the brief.
Correct.
And so now you're focused on the factual prong. Correct. In other words, you've laid out what the test was and you're focused on the factual prong. And so your argument is on these facts there was no prejudice.
Yes, on these facts there was no prejudice with respect to, first of all, there was the right to public trial at the time that counsel filed it would not have been aware that the right to public trial was implicated by this perfunctory taking of a not guilty plea in chambers.
Well, if we didn't agree with your characterization of the arraignment as perfunctory, since it seems as though that arraignment would be the same arraignment that would have happened in open court, What's your argument about how appellate counsel was not ineffective for failing to raise this issue?
Okay, so if you're assuming that this was an adversarial proceeding?
Yes.
Okay, so counsel was not ineffective in that she also made a decision about which right to public trial violations to raise. So you have to presume that appellate counsel, and particularly in the appellate context, is strongly, the presumption is strong that counsel is effective.
So it's a strategic decision.
Yes.
And so, you base that on the first opinion where we know that appellate counsel did raise a public trial right.
That's correct. And this court has to take in consideration the case law at the time. So, and there wasn't any case law out there about rearrangements occurring in chambers on amendments. And in particular, one of the changes in here was a technical amendment, was simply the changing of the dates with respect to some of the charges.
Wasn't it also true, though, that this was the second amended information?
Correct,
he was never actually arraigned on the first amended information.
That's correct. The state tried to have him arraigned in February of 2009. This case went to trial in December of 2009. At that point, he had not been rearranged.
In fact, the trial court raised a question of probable cause. At the attempt to arraign him on the first amended information?
Well, defense counsel raised it initially, and all the trial court said was, your probable cause affidavit's got to cover this, and then it was sort of left to the state, the prosecutor, to determine whether or not the probable cause affidavit covered it.
So wouldn't we have to look at sort of these two different arraignments tied together as opposed to just isolating the analysis for the rearrangement?
Yes, I would agree with that, Your Honor. But the issue about the amendment was litigated in open court. So defense counsel did take exception to the amendment of the information, and the court found that there was no prejudice to the defendant and that there was and that he had notice from February 2009 regarding the additional charges. And so what the first amended information unfortunately stated that there were four rape of a child in the first degree instead of two in the second degree and two in the first degree. So in addition, petitioner has to show that prejudice from the ineffective assistance of counsel. So in this context, he has to show that the appellate court would have reversed she had asserted that issue. And you can't make that showing in this context because the violation is separable and it's not structural.
But if we were to conclude that, the only relief we could give him would be a rearrangement now, and is that effective relief?
It is with respect to the violation that he's alleged, Your Honor, and it's my understanding that's not the remedy he seeks, and the only remedy he seeks is a reversal of the trial, the conviction itself.
I understand. I was just...
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be just sort of an anomaly to rearrange someone who had already been convicted of the crimes that he was being rearranged on?
Well, it'd sort of be like, you know, rearranging them on a technical amendment. Sometimes they have to be rearranged, and sometimes they don't on amendments to the information. So... you know, it'd be a technicality that could occur.
So you're treating the second. I don't really like the term rearrangement.
Arraignment on amended information.
You're treating the amendment to the information and the arraignment that took place in chambers. As a technical amendment?
The amendment of the information?
Yes.
In this context, there is, in the due process context, it's not a substantive amendment because he had notice back in February 2009 of the charges, the four charges, and there's been no prejudice. And so that actually was litigated by the... in open court, and so the judge concluded there's not a due process violation. You had notice. You've not shown me any prejudice, and so therefore we're going to go and amend this. And, and the only reason why he didn't do it in open court at that time was because...
He had the jury pool.
And there were a couple of... there was this error in that the information referred to four in the title, four counts of rape of a child in the first degree, whereas actually the substance of those counts, there were two that rape of a child in the second degree and two were rape of a child in the first degree.
And I haven't looked at the record.
Prisoner's error.
And I haven't looked at the record, but I assume the court told the jury what the charges were?
I have to assume so. I have not looked at that part of the record, and I don't know if that's been provided as part of his petition. With respect to In re Morris does not control in this situation.
Well, before we, well, go ahead, go with Morris.
Because there is no voir dire at issue here. So you do not have the structural error component that In re Morris was predicated upon, in which there was interviewing of the voir dire in a closed courtroom. So you have a separable part of the entire case occurring, and it's separable from the trial itself. Waller itself said that the remedy is supposed to fit the violation. With respect to Bone Club, the only reason that they remanded for a new trial was because the court felt that the suppression hearing testimony might have changed the officer's testimony at trial, or that he might have been able to be impeached. We don't have any testimony. We don't have any witnesses. The purpose of the right to public trial would not be furthered by having this perfunctory and pro forma taking of a not guilty plea on an amended information happening in court, in open court.
Thank you. You have 2 minutes.
Let me get to the remedy question, which with some degree of candor really caught me off guard, but I think I covered pretty well. The Rolodex of my mind did not work as fast as Westlaw did when I sat down. State versus Easterling. Easterling is a case where the co-defendant's pretrial motions were closed. So it was a motion to sever and a motion to dismiss, and Mr. Easterling was not allowed to be present in the courtroom, was closed during that hearing. The Washington Supreme Court reversed, and they reversed because they found that it was a structural error. And they didn't analyze whether there was anything from that hearing that would have prejudiced Mr. Easterling in his trial. So there was no analysis done of did Mr. Easterling suffer at trial because he didn't watch the pretrial or the public wasn't able to see the pretrial hearing of his co-defendant. So there was no analysis that way in terms of can you just partition this off, nor did they remand it for a new severance hearing with Mr. Easterling and the public being allowed to be present. They said instead that reversal and remand for a new trial was required, and it was dictated by our interest in protecting the transparency and fairness of criminal trials by ensuring that all stages of courtroom proceedings remain open unless the trial court identifies a compelling interest to be served by closure. In that particular case, they found no compelling interest, and so I'll move then to the holding of the court. They said the appropriate remedy for this error of constitutional magnitude is reversal of the conviction and remand for proceedings consistent with this opinion, and that's what I would ask for in this case.
Thank you.